Okay, Thursday, May 29th, 2003. This is the ontology tutorial by Adam Pease.
Okay, and I'll also ask that in terms of coordinating the questions on the wiki, that if Peter would sort of flag them for me verbally if I don't notice them during the presentation, so people do get their questions answered, but we only have Peter jumping in to actually interrupt the presentation and let me know there's a question. As much as possible. If we wind up with only seven people, then I think we can be a little bit freer.
Okay.
So why don't we get started, and possibly other people will come in as needed. Okay, I think we've got the first page up on Peter's machine. And so if everybody just to make sure they've got Introduction to Ontology. So this is the rough schedule that I've put up here. And of course, encourage people that if you don't ask questions during this presentation, feel free to email them to the list as well as to me later on. So now I'm on the second slide, ground rules. So I anticipate that I'll start off doing a lot of just one-way lecturing, but then as we move on, that people may have more questions. I'm going to try to keep this practical. There are a lot of sort of really deep philosophical issues that we could go into. I'd be happy to go into them at another juncture or offline. But I'll try to keep this on philosophy with a small p rather than a capital P, and really just trying to look at practical issues in knowledge engineering. And try to let you know about choices we've made amongst the many alternatives there are for representation that allow us to make a decision and get on with doing some practical work. And also, since I realize we've got a range of expertise here, I want to encourage people that there is no such thing as a dumb question, and feel free to ask anything that's on target. So now I'm on the third slide, definitions. So ontology is originally coined as a word in the philosophy community. It meant something very lofty, the study of the nature of being or nature of truth. We're in fact looking at something far more practical here, really practical from a computer science and information science sort of sense. And there are really two ways that one can look at this more general definition. The ontology is just a shared conceptualization of a domain. A little more specific definition, ontology is a set of definitions and a formal language for terms in our world. And that's really what we'll be focusing on. And the key component of that definition is the formal language. One could certainly define as sort of semi-formal or informal ontology as a set of terms and English definitions, but to my mind, that would be more like a dictionary as opposed to a true formal ontology. So the formal language is key.
This is Jim Warner from Boeing.
Hi, okay, Jim, we're on slide four now.
Thank you.
So that's motivation. So let me try to illustrate why ontology is valuable and current technology is not sufficient. So imagine one had an SQL statement like the following on the slide. Select MDAT from first tab.
Hi, this is Scott Harden. Sorry.
Okay, we're on slide four now.
Thank you.
Select MDAT from first tab where pause equals MGMT. So this is a sort of what one might expect to see in a practical relational database. And of course, it's fairly meaningless to somebody just jumping in. So we could certainly have a set of English definitions, a data dictionary that would describe all these things, but fundamentally still, if that's in English or another human language, a human has to read it to understand what the true semantics of these terms actually mean. And there are all sorts of possible questions that might come up which may or may not be answered by those English definitions, such as, if first tab is a table which lists employee data, what is an employee? How is an employee different from a contractor? What if I want data on both? There are all sorts of boundary cases that will certainly exist for what it means to be an employee. And unless we've had a very, very careful data administrator document all those boundary cases, it's not going to be clear where the boundaries lie. And even if they have been specified, they're going to be specified in English, and there's no way for a machine to do the sort of constraint checking that one would want to have done automatically. So, next slide, slide five. Here's an example that I used in a document I have posted on the DARPA agent markup language site called Why Use DAML. So let's assume we have a couple of statements. Parenthood is more general than motherhood as a relation, and that Mary is the mother of Bill. And we want to answer the question, who are Bill's parents, and get back the obvious answer, Mary is the parent of Bill. Problem is, this fact is actually not stated anywhere. We only have the statement, Mary is the mother of Bill, not that Mary is the parent of Bill. So there's actually some inference that has to happen. So a basic web search kind of application will actually not find the answer because there's no literal match. Now, a database application or an XML application could encode this information, and it could have some stored procedures that would allow this inference to take place. But fundamentally, the fact is not stated anywhere, and so we need to do some sort of computational computation to come up with this conclusion. Let's go on to slide 6. So more formally stated, given these statements, mother of is a subproperty of parent of, Mary is the mother of Bill, and when formally stated in DAML or another logical language would allow you to include Mary is the parent of Bill. So going into more detail about what I started saying, Java code or stored procedure could do this sort of inference, but the fundamental thing is that one needs a formal language that requires that that inference is true. So you could also have these statements in XML or SQL and have an application which would be completely compliant with those standards and yet not be able to conclude the conclusion that you want. Whereas in a formal language like DAML, specifies the necessary properties of the standard, specifies that parent that the subproperty.
Hi, this is Mike DeConta. Sorry, I'm late.
Hi, Mike. We're on slide 6. And DAML specifies that subproperty is one of these standard relations with the formal properties of inference that allow you to do this sort of conclusion. A DAML-compliant application is going to be necessarily allowed to make this particular conclusion, as opposed to merely that it's capable of doing so if a programmer comes up with the implementation for it. Okay, next slide. So another example is inverses, just to sort of expanding a little bit, because RDF has these class-subclass relations. DAML is a little bit more sophisticated, and I'll show you later that TIFF is even a level of sophistication above that. So here we have example of parent of is the inverse of child of, and so if we ask what's the answer for Bill is child of who, then we want to get the answer Mary, and this again is dependent upon the formal semantics of the term inverse, what it actually means. It allows us to conclude that if Bill is the child of Mary, that Mary is the parent of Bill, and vice versa. Part of the value of formal semantics for these terms in a formal language. So now on to slide 8, language formality and expressiveness. So just an attempt to try to put some different languages in context. This sort of slide is always a fairly imperfect rendition, but hopefully it's illustrative. So looking at both the expressiveness of a language and its formality, human language is extremely expressive and extremely informal. And it requires the human mind, with all of the learning and knowledge and history that any human has, to actually do the disambiguation, resolve the problems in the lack of formality, and in order to understand what those sentences or utterances actually mean. Farther on the realm of formality are things that can be machine processed, like SQL or XML. They don't have a lot of formal semantics. They have a lot of syntax expression. One could argue that SQL has a completely formal semantics. It does, but it's not terribly expressive. And then as we get farther over to the right, there are extremely expressive and formal languages. DAML is quite formal, but in early versions of DAML, it wasn't terribly expressive. Now with the Ontology Web Language, it's considerably more expressive, and that's why I lumped together languages like TIFF, F-Logic, OWL, and SciGL roughly in the same cloud of languages that are both very formal and rather expressive, approaching the expressivity of human language, although certainly still quite a distance from there. found a content formality and size, so I've addressed issues of language. And this slide really tries to point out that there's something besides language. A tremendous amount of effort in the computer science research communities goes into developing languages. Very little, comparatively, goes into developing content or formal knowledge that has a long life. So here the slide is showing a trade-off between the size of that content and the degree of formality. So one example of a fairly informal large body of content is Yahoo. It's just a big taxonomy, and the relationships between terms are not really defined other than, you know, one term is somewhat more general than another or more specific than another. In the middle are things that are semi-formal, lexicons like WordNet or UMLS, that have a certain amount of structure, and they're very large. In general, they're not suitable for formal logical inference. They're really semi-formal representations. WordNet is very useful for linguistic tasks, but not for formal inference. And then at the far right are true formal ontologies in logical languages with formal semantics that machine can use to do inference. Dolce is a formal ontology that the European community is developing. There's our own Sumo, which we've decided on for the UBL ontology project. And then also there is Psyche. So now slide 10. Everything is not a nail, so I'm hot on ontology. I think it's a great solution. I think it's something that the computer science industry and research community needs desperately, but of course it's not the only solution. I don't want to overhype it. Ontology is not always the right tool for the job, and there are a large number of other sorts of problems. Just to be very clear about what our boundaries for this work are, things like face recognition, vehicle control systems, anything that's primarily involved with numerical computation, pattern recognition, stuff like that, not really the right paradigm for ontology. However, the outputs or inputs of such systems, especially where they interface to other symbolic systems, that really can be the right application for ontology, where there's high-level, cognitive-level information interchange. Slide 11. Lots of different ways to use ontologies. There's a whole spectrum here from the not really using the ontology at all at runtime to using it very heavily. So let me just go through each of these in turn. So one can use ontology really as just an information engineering tool. In a way, that's what we're doing on the UBL ontology project. We don't have really a computational system yet. We're just trying to do some information modeling and take advantage of a formal ontology in helping us structure that information model. So one can do things like use an ontology and then compile out to a database schema, map that schema to the upper ontology, and also really use the ontology as a set of reminders for the knowledge engineer, information engineer. A large upper ontology like Sumo contains within it a lot of very fundamental distinctions about our world. And if you try to map an information model into that ontology, you're forced to make some very fundamental decisions. Is the term you're talking about a physical thing or an abstract thing? Is it an object or a process? And all of these individual distinctions are really just, in a way, a set of reminders for letting the knowledge engineer, the information engineer, know what are some decisions that really have to be made and what are some assumptions that really have to be made explicit for some other user down the line to understand what the author actually meant by a particular term. One of the projects that I did several years ago for a commercial customer was creating a large real estate web portal where we had to integrate 30,000 different real estate databases. And so we created a formal ontology in Logic using an upper ontology, and then we compiled out to a relational database schema. And then in terms of what was running live behind their site 24/7, it was just a relational database, very conventional technology. But the information design, the schema design of that database was done on the basis of formal ontology. So we had a very robust data warehouse that was able to adapt to the needs of representation that were embodied in all of these 30,000 disparate databases. So at the next level, one can really use an ontology as a set of more formal comments, really using it heavily at design time, and even doing things like using a formal theorem prover at design time to check for inconsistencies. So rather than having groups of engineers poring over data dictionaries with comments specified in English and trying to make sure that they have a consistent, coherent representation, one can actually start to use formal methods, including theorem proving, to actually test whether there are any contradictions in the logical representations. At the next level, stuff like we've done on the DARPA DAML project for taxonomic reasoning is to do very limited sorts of inference that can be done very, very quickly, such as class-subclass reasoning or inverse reasoning, like the example that I showed before. And for this, you can employ all sorts of different high-performance tools, including Prolog, Description Logics, or Java. So doing very limited sorts of inference. And then at the far extreme, where I do the most of my research, is in doing full first-order logical inference, actually doing full inference at runtime. So there's really this whole range of uses that one can target that to meet the needs for what's appropriate for the particular application you might be developing. So slide 12, upper ontology, and that's where I'll start turning our focus here, in particular upper ontology. It's an attempt to capture the most general and reusable terms and definitions, rather than creating every ontology from scratch, making use of an existing product. And that can have a tremendous amount of leverage in the information design world, just as it does in the software development world. Slide 13, motivation. Ontologies can have lots of different names for the same thing, so different ontologies may call the relationship between a class and an instance a type, instance, ISA, or something else. Ontologies, in turn, may also have the same name for different things, such as one ontology having a time-point representation of time and another really focusing on time intervals, and they may both have the same relation called before, and you really want to be clear on what's actually meant by both of those. So one of the ways to avoid this kind of confusion is to standardize or agree on a common upper ontology, or at the very least map legacy products to it, so that there's a common language for expressing what's actually meant in different systems. Slide 14, as I alluded to before, there are a number of formal upper ontologies that I'm aware of, Dolce, Psych, and Sumo. We've discussed on the list various trade-offs in these. At the moment, this group settled on Sumo, and that's what I'll be talking about today. So a simple methodology that I sent out back to the list probably a month or two ago. First, start with some kind of source text. Look at doing a bottom-up representation that then gets linked into an upper ontology. Start extracting things like nouns and verbs from the source text to identify what are the things in the world that we care about in a particular application that are going to need to be modeled. Then find classes in an upper ontology in Sumo for those nouns and verbs, and start mapping those terms to the upper ontology and try to get an initial definition for what these things actually mean. Now, one of the initial steps that we've often taken is to, at the very least, when that mapping is done, try to determine whether there's an equivalence or if it's a subsumption sort of match. Now, Sumo is a very general ontology, so it's quite likely that for any particular notion that one might extract out of an English text, that it's going to be a subsumption sort of mapping. Now, the next step, we really start to get into the meat of creating an ontology, is actually starting to add properties to the subclass, either by reusing existing properties or extending the properties that are in the hierarchy of properties in Sumo. Next, start adding English definitions to the class that express in crisp English sentences what the class actually means. And then finally, trying to formalize those English definitions fully in logic. So now, why don't we start the exercise? This is slide 16. So my goal is to walk through the process of creating some ontology content from source text using the methodology that I introduced on the last slide. And my hope is that this will give people some practical familiarity with both the logical language of KIF and the Sumo Ontology. So slide 17, and looks like, forgive me, I developed this presentation originally for military customers, so it's using the topic of international terrorism. So the first task on this slide is to identify the items that need formalization. Look at the nouns and verbs and just underline them. So a very simple first step. So why don't I suggest that people cut and paste or take a piece of paper and write things down, give everybody a few minutes to do that, and then we'll move on to the next slide. And let's see, try to think of, it's very easy to coordinate this in person. Peter, do you have any suggestions for how we can best coordinate this virtually?
Not particularly. I mean,
maybe we could have people use the wiki. In fact, we could have people put their initials down on the wiki whenever they're done, and then you can monitor that and let me know when we've got a critical mass of people that have said they're done.
Right. I mean, the problem with the wiki is at any one point it's only expecting one person to edit it, and there's no locking mechanism, so it's probably not a very appropriate platform for sort of collaborative mock-up. What can we do?
I have a little bit of a detailed question. This is Jim Warner from Boeing. I'm trying to do this just because I find this interesting thing to do. I see that there are, and maybe this is something you'll get into, I'm picking out what I think are nouns, and I see nouns that are, in this case, used as adjectives.
Okay.
So is the form, is the word itself of interest, or how it's used?
How it's used, the concept behind the word.
Okay.
And just the initial step in the exercise is just to identify the words, and then as we go on, we'll refine that a little bit.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I guess for those who are on VNC, it would be easier because it's a shared screen. We could mark up the slide, and I guess if someone calls it in, I'll help maybe mark it up or something. How about that?
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll just give, why don't I give people 2 minutes now just to try it themselves, and then we'll check back in.
Okay.
So, silence is intentional.
An additional slide. Right, for those who are on VNC, you notice I've got first exercise 1A. And if people can verbally tell me what to mark up, I can mark it up by maybe coloring it or something, particular words. Who wants to give nouns?
Here's my list of nouns that I pulled out. This is Jim Warner again.
Okay, great.
Nationals.
Nationals, okay. All right.
Origin.
Origin.
I can't see what you're doing, so I'll try to paste.
Okay, I've got nationals and origin marked in green.
Ferry.
I made a mistake on 7. Where? Ferry?
Ferry.
Okay.
Trabzon. Last word in the first sentence.
Oh, yeah. Got it.
Hijackers.
Hijackers. Yep.
Russians. separatists. Dagestan. Russia. I'm kind of confused about the date reference there, but let's just say January. You can highlight hijackers again, I guess, although we've already identified them. Authorities. Entrance. Bosporus. And passengers. Maybe somebody else can handle the verbs.
Okay, any volunteers for verbs?
This is Kurt, I'll jump in. Hijacked. Threatened to kill.
And what's the next one?
Threatened to kill, third line down.
Third line down. Oh, threatened?
Yeah.
Oh, threatened to kill.
Yeah, the whole phrase.
Yep.
Whole phrase.
Actually, in the weight theater, it doesn't matter too much logging these, because the goal of the coordination is just to make sure that people are done, and now that everybody's sharing their information, that goal has kind of been achieved.
Okay,
so
all right.
I'll actually have on the next slide my take on everything. So why don't we continue, Kurt?
Okay.
Can I ask a question? It's Mike Conta. What about also maybe identifying some of the adjectives and what they modify?
Yes, that can be important as well. So why don't we let Kurt finish through, and then I'll give you my take on things.
Okay, next verb I got was held,
all right.
Followed by released, surrendered, and then unarmed.
Okay,
so Mike had a really good point. In fact, one way to do this is to look at things like noun phrases and verb phrases as opposed to individual nouns and verbs. Because often that grouping of words into phrases points to concepts as opposed to individual words, and ultimately it's the concepts we want to get at. So why doesn't everybody turn to slide 18 now, and you'll see one way of doing this underlining. This is a fairly informal kind of way to start, so there's not exactly a right or wrong answer on this. It's just a method for getting started. One of the things that just got mentioned, and also was mentioned when I did this tutorial last week, was the date that I could have underlined. And that was, I think, an excellent thing to capture. Because certainly one would want to capture the temporal qualification on this whole event. So now my suggestion is, you know, go through and create terms that correspond to these nouns, verbs, or verb phrases, and try to remove the redundancy. There are several cases in this paragraph where different words are used to point to the same thing. And since we're capturing concepts, not expression or communication, it's very important to remove that redundancy. And then also try to pay attention, are there any sort of background or implicit notions that are not explicit in the text? Ultimately, there's kind of an infinite number of different facts about the world that help us as humans understand what's happened in the story, but try to think a little bit about, is there anything that's sort of lurking just below the surface there? So why don't I give everybody a few minutes for that? Just as you're done, maybe we'll have people just say your name. we should probably specify that there's a boundary that divides the groups, and it's a national boundary in this case.
Good.
This is Jonathan Shire. Maybe there's an implication that the Chechen separatists were not released since the hijackers ended up surrendering.
Okay, good. Okay. So why don't we move on to slide 19? And then you can see there the individual terms that I thought we would need to create. So one of the things that we have to do in terms of removing ambiguity is that there are passengers generically in the last sentence, and then there are also Russians on board, and that they refer to at least the same thing if we come to the assumption that there aren't any people other than Russians on board, or at least one is a subset of the other, if we assume there are.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
This is John Harden with Envision. At this point, on slide 18, I'm following the instruction on the second bullet that says, now create terms that correspond to the noun and verbs. I jumped to kind of an abstraction of what we had, or what we have in the paragraph, and started to define, for example, Turkish nationals as citizens or as nationals or also as residents. Is that improper? Should we be at the exact definition level, or are we looking to go up to an abstraction to define kind of a semantic layer?
No, I think you're doing, in fact, exactly the right thing, and you may be a step ahead of some other folks.
Okay. I apologize.
No, that's great.
Thank you.
One other thing, and this might come on implicit things, I think it's implicitly really important to understand that at a high level, this paragraph discusses two events that are related, the first being the hijacking, the second being the surrendering. In terms of modeling this overall, I would hope to see something like that.
Yeah, I agree. So if you look on slide 19 now, you'll see my take on these different terms. So we certainly need notions for Turkey, Chechnya, Russia, the notion of nationality, events like hijacking, threatening, killing, releasing, and holding, the notion of being a separatist, physical things like a ferry, regions like an entrance, the notion of being unharmed, relations like bound for or being on board a vehicle. This is just an initial set. There certainly could be a lot more things, but these are just a few that I came up with. And folks have come up with a bunch of other things that I think are excellent. Let me move on to slide 20. So now that you've gotten sort of the briefest taste of how one might do a bottom-up ontology creation approach, let me go a little bit top-down, try to give you a little more understanding of what's in our upper ontology so we can use it effectively. Final exercise. So at the high level at SUMO, the most fundamental distinction, now I'm on slide 21, is the division between physical things and abstract things. Physical things are things that have a position on a timeline and some position in physical space, and abstracts are things which don't. Abstract things are like numbers or concepts. Physical things can be, as we see then on the next slide, slide 22, either objects or processes, either things in the world or things that happen in the world. Slide 23, further going down the hierarchy of objects, there's the notion of a self-connected object, which is then further decomposed into what you might colloquially called stuff or things, substances or corpuscular objects. Substance is a collection of stuff, like water or air, that if you divide an instance of this substance, it still retains its identity. If I take a cup of water and I pour it into two different cups, I've just moved it around. I haven't changed its identity. There's now just two individual instances of water. Whereas if I take a chair and I cut it in half, I don't have two chairs anymore. I have just collections of wood or metal or something. There are all sorts of boundary cases for this that I'd be happy to discuss with people offline, but sort of take the central case, and hopefully that'll be informative. There are also notions like a region or a collection.
Peter Yim here. Thing like substance, how could you sort of formally define it so that it's unambiguous?
Well, hopefully if you look in Sumo and type substance in the browser, you'll see a collection of axioms that attempt to do just that, defining it unambiguously.
Okay.
I probably don't have time to go into the full detail now, but I'd encourage you to do that. If you have any questions about how we've represented something, maybe we can continue that discussion on the list. Okay, next slide, the 24 processes. So there's a whole hierarchy of processes, roughly about 175, that have the five top-level divisions that are here unindented: dual object process, internal change, shape change, intentional process, and motion. And I've also included the next level of the hierarchy in blue, and I've highlighted a couple of these in white that have particular relevance to the example exercise, the notions of guiding, social interaction, and transportation. On to slide 25.
Why was guiding highlighted?
Guiding is particularly a relevant concept to our exercise. So the notion of steering a vehicle is a case of guiding. Slide 25, the abstract portion of the hierarchy. This portion is a little bit harder to grasp, of course, because they are just abstract things, but we do have a notion of a set or a class, relation, proposition, quantity. Number is particularly important. We want to be able to count things and talk about their units, attributes, things that are tend to be very transient, not true parts of an object's identity, are often declared as attributes. And then very abstract mathematical things like graphs or graphs elements. So on to slide 26. Now I've given you a whirlwind tour of the top levels of the ontology. We try to give you the briefest introduction to some of the features of formal logic so that we'll have some of the tools or building blocks that we need in order to make the next step of the exercise work.
This is Mike Conner. I have one question related to what's your thoughts on, take the guiding versus steering distinction. One could argue that guiding and steering are two different things and that one may not be a subclass of the other. So let's say that in Sumo or in some other ontology that they are a subclass, but that you disagree with that definition, or the definition is actually worse for your application than better. What kind of, what do you do? Just don't use that ontology and then you're back to, reinventing the wheel? Or what kind of, have you run into that before?
Well, we've run into very often assumptions that something may be out of place, and we've run into fairly often cases of actual errors. So let me try to take the different possible cases in turn. One thing to keep really clear is that there's language and then there's ontology. And the terms in the ontology have labels on them, but those labels are not definitive. They're illustrative. So if we name something guiding or we name something steering, what that term really means is the formal axioms, the associated with it. We could just as well have called every term GenSim 27, GenSim 35, and that would make it a little bit more obvious that the English labels are not part of the definition. They're merely a convenience for humans to help them grasp the ontology, much in the same way that the English documentation strings are a convenience for humans. So if somebody believes that a particular term, such as steering, is incorrect, it'll have to be on the basis of what's the formal definition, what do the axioms say that just aren't true. And occasionally, of course, we do find that there are errors like that, and then we fix them. Cases where we may, in fact, even have unwittingly included a logical contradiction between two axioms, and so the axioms need to be reformulated. So I'd say it's fairly rare that we'll encounter a case where there's some assumption that's so fundamental that it would require one to just use another ontology.
I'd like to just ask a question. If this is this term that it's using, guiding or steering, it seems to be something similar to what library science people know as a descriptor. Is that in fact the case here?
So I'm not a library scientist, but from it sounds right.
Yeah. Basically, it's what they refer to as a preferred term in a controlled vocabulary.
Okay.
And this would be the symbol that is the term that is used in the controlled vocabulary to as sort of one among many, that is the term that they'll use for indexing purposes and searching and other uses of relating those terms.
Right. So, in
throughout processes.
A good way of illustrating this point further is that we have foreign language translations of our ontology into Czech, and Italian, and Mandarin Chinese as well. And I should say just that Chinese traditional character set, not specifically Mandarin, because that's spoken. And there we just have these different labels in different human languages for the term, but the real definition, the real meaning for the term is embodied in the logical axioms, not in the label that we supply for human convenience.
Right, okay. I think it is very analogous.
Mike, did that answer your original question?
Yes, but there's an implicit assumption there. So then if I have an OWL ontology, I believe you're saying that it's not complete unless each class in there actually has the axioms that formally define it.
That's right.
And what is the language for, is there work on a standardized language for those axioms?
Well, let's see. So yes, that there is. For the project at the moment, we're using a version of KIF, which doesn't have any formal standards status, but it does have a specification that we've remained consistent with for this particular ontology. And I believe that by choosing SUMO, we've made it, at the very least, an implicit choice to go with KIF.
Okay. And do you know what the plan is for that in the OWL realm?
Well, so that whole community is undergoing a lot of transition. We started off with the DAML-L language several years ago, and it's morphed several times to become incrementally more expressive. And now OWL, I believe, has been accepted as a W3C standard. But there are also three different levels of OWL, none of which is as expressive as KIF. So we had the discussion, I think, on the ontolog list a little while ago about why OWL is... I guess that was another email list I was involved in. OWL, one of the problems with OWL right now is that it only allows binary relations. So if you want to say something is between two other things, it's very convoluted to do so, which I think renders it largely unsuitable for serious knowledge representation.
I don't know whether that was captured on the this discussion that was discussed verbally at one of the weekly calls, I remember.
Right.
Okay, yeah, I know. I understand. understand that, and I've heard that many people complain about the binary relations. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So let's go on from abstract now to a little bit of logic, slide 26. So there are things in ontology such as instances, so particular individuals like George Bush or Iraq or Bob's big right big toe. And then there are also classes, sets of things, like humans, the class of all humans, which includes the instance George Bush, or the class of all nations, which includes Iraq and the United States and so forth. There are also relations, such that one event, World War I, happened before another event, World War II, or that, as in my initial examples, Bill is a child of Mary. In Suo Kif, we use the characters equal greater than, which you can read as implies, and it's basically equivalent to a conditional in a procedural programming language, except that it can be applied during a search that's conducted at any time. It's just a declaration as opposed to a procedure, but it roughly means if X, then Y. So implies takes two arguments, the X and the Y. And that should be familiar to any programmer. X and Y are true, or X or Y, or both are true. That's a key difference with English. Or in logic is an inclusive or, whereas or is often used in English as an exclusive or. It may be X or Y, but not both. But logic is different on this fact. It's an inclusive or. Negation, so putting a not in front of any particular sentence, so it gives the opposite truth value. So if X is true, then if you put not in front of it, it's false. And lastly, existential quantification.